Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Jennifer Lowenstein, former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies and Senior Lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who assesses the escalating attacks between Israel and Hezbollah that could erupt into an all-out war. Amy Littlefield, The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent, who examines the first documented deaths of women linked to state anti-abortion laws and the possible political consequences in the 2024 election. And Lisa Finn, an organizer with Third Act Virginia, who talks about the September 19th protest at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, where residents of the Gulf Coast oppose the permitting of new liquefied natural gas export terminals. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Following Libya's brutal civil war and NATO intervention that ousted dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, the North African country has settled into an uneasy peace. Since an internationally brokered ceasefire in 2020, Libya's Prime Minister Abdul al-Dabiba, who controls the capital of Tripoli, has battled General Khalifa Haftar, who rules eastern Libya, over influence of key institutions like the Central Bank and the National Oil Corporation, through which most of Libya's oil revenue flows. In late August, Dabiba ordered his military to take over Libya's central bank, which has Africa's largest foreign exchange reserves, and forced the bank's governor, Sadiq al-Kabir, into exile in Turkey. Kabir is said to have sowed the seeds of his own demise by funding both factions vying for power, while smuggling Libya's subsidized oil to Europe. In response to Kabir's ouster, General Haftar shut down the oil wells that provide Libya with 95% of its revenue. On September 3rd, the United Nations body that oversees Libya's post-Gaddafi transition proposed a process to appoint a new central bank governor that both sides are now considering. Meanwhile, General Haftar's troops are massing in the oil-rich southwest and are threatening to attack Tripoli, as they did back in 2019. Last winter, Florida construction worker Alexander Leitner sent off a message on his mobile phone declaring his intention to commit mass murder via the Telegram social media platform. Leitner used language popular with a new generation of neo-Nazis who call themselves accelerationists. Accelerationists seek to provoke the collapse of Western civilization and replace democracies with white ethno-states. Among Telegram's roughly 900 million users, extremists post on multiple channels to encourage followers to commit mass murder, carry out political assassinations, and engage in acts of sabotage against the electrical grid and other critical infrastructure. Recent attention was focused on Telegram after its CEO, Pavel Durov, was arrested by French authorities on charges related to alleged criminal activity on his platform that included organized fraud, drug trafficking, pornographic images of minors, as well as refusal to cooperate with authorities. A ProPublica investigation found that social media platforms such as Steam, Discord, and Gab also host extremist-related content, but Telegram is by far the most widely used and accessible. Vice President Kamala Harris has raised over $540 million in campaign cash since entering the race for the White House and has a big cash advantage over Republican candidate Donald Trump. While congressional candidates and Democratic fundraising committees have enjoyed a huge fundraising surge, Republicans still have an advantage in election campaigns for control of state legislative bodies. The GOP still controls the majority of state legislatures, giving them more power over those states' budgets, election laws, gerrymandering, and abortion policies. The Guardian reports Republican committees for state legislative races have a $25 million cash advantage over Democrats. And in battleground states like Pennsylvania, they're outspending Democrats by a nearly 3-to-1 margin. While the Harris campaign and the Democratic National Committee recently transferred more than $25 million into state legislative races, they haven't erased the Republican cash advantage. But independent progressive groups are now looking to fill the gap, such as the Forward Majority Super PAC, which is spending $45 million on state legislative races, and the State's Project, which has pledged to spend $70 million during the 2024 election cycle. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The long-feared escalation of cross-border rocket and missile attacks between Israel and Hezbollah that began after Israel launched a brutal air and ground assault on Gaza following the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel has been building for months. The latest spiral of violence began after Israel's July 30th assassination of a Hezbollah commander in Beirut and a mid-September covert Israeli operation that blew up thousands of pagers and walkie-talkies carried by the Lebanese militia group's members and civilians that killed 40 and injured some 3,000. Growing concern that the region was on the brink of an all-out war were bolstered after Israel launched 650 airstrikes against 1,600 Hezbollah targets across Lebanon on September 23rd that killed more than 500 people, the deadliest day the country has seen in nearly 20 years. After Israel sent automated calls and text messages to civilians directing them to evacuate Lebanese cities and towns, tens of thousands fled their homes. As Israel's indiscriminate deadly attacks on civilians in Gaza continued, an IDF spokesperson, when asked, didn't rule out a future ground invasion of Lebanon. Your reporter spoke with Jennifer Lowenstein, former associate director of Middle Eastern Studies and senior lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who lived in and reported from both Beirut and Gaza. Here she talks about the consequences of a regional war and what steps the U.S. could take to pressure Israel to accept a ceasefire in Gaza and de-escalate its deepening and dangerous conflict with Hezbollah.
Hezbollah began its cross-border attacks on northern Israel as a support front for the people of Gaza. When the Gaza war began, if you can call it a war, Hezbollah, in solidarity, began firing rockets over the border. This caused approximately 60,000 Israelis in the north to have to leave, to be evacuated southward. And at the beginning of this attack in October of last year, Benny Gantz and Netanyahu and others wanted immediately to attack Hezbollah. Apparently, the United States did put pressure on them to stop, to not do that. But since then, there's been back and forth attack between the IDF and Hezbollah. What people don't realize is that 83% of those rocket attacks and barrages of missiles have come from Israel, and that in South Lebanon, you have over 100,000 people who, before today, had to leave their homes. You have basically what one reporter called a dead zone being created in South Lebanon. And this is being created because Israel basically has been saying to Lebanon and Hezbollah that they want Hezbollah to withdraw north behind the Litani River, so that the residents of northern Israel can go back and feel safe. And as one writer said, it would be easier to move the Litani River south than to make Hezbollah withdraw north. In other words, it's not going to happen. Now, just to put into some perspective the events of today, people were saying that this is the heaviest bombardment that Lebanon has experienced since the war in 2006. But in fact, that's not true. This is the heaviest bombardment in Lebanon since the Lebanese Civil War of 1975 to 1990. That should give people an idea of how heavy this bombing was. Most of the targeted sites have been Shia areas. That's because Hezbollah is a Shia political party as well as a militia. And Israel considers it probably its most threatening foe in the Middle East, next to Iran.
Jennifer, President Biden and his administration have been totally ineffective in its dozens of calls for a ceasefire in Gaza and a de-escalation of tensions between Israel and Hezbollah over these many months. But Biden has refused to apply any pressure on Netanyahu and Israel by threatening to withhold U.S. military aid for Israelis' gross human rights abuses in Gaza, and of course, these pending charges of war crimes that are being committed in Gaza. What do you think is holding back the Biden administration from really confronting head-on Benjamin Netanyahu's his approach to all these conflicts is a military solution rather than diplomacy? He seems to think that because he's got this military might at his disposal, that that's the only tool he's going to use to settle the problems in that part of the world.
You know, it's very easy for people to look at this scenario and say that somehow Israel is controlling the United States. I don't see it that way. Biden's, you know, demand and his, people in his government demanding a ceasefire, I think that's a charade. Yes, they want it in an abstract sense, but they could get a ceasefire tonight. It could happen tonight if Biden wanted it, if the administration wanted it. The fact is they don't. The U.S. wants to maintain its hegemony in the Middle East, and Israel is the spearhead of the United States empire, of U.S. imperial power. Whether people want to hear those words or not, that's a fact. The United States wants to maintain its role as a global superpower and as the superpower that has most of its control in the Middle East. And Israel is basically conducting U.S. policy, maybe not the way the administration in Washington really wanted it, but they're still doing it. So the Biden administration is sitting back, and they know exactly what's going on. They see exactly what's happening. When the Biden administration, for example, blames Hamas for the failure to reach a ceasefire, it's a joke, because it's not Hamas that is blocking a ceasefire deal. It's Israel. Every time Hamas has come out and said, we accept this, Netanyahu ups the ante. Well, now we have to control the Philadelphia corridor. Well, now we need to have a buffer zone within Gaza. Well, now, you know, it keeps going on like this. That doesn't bother the Biden administration. They're fine with it. Mm-hmm. Israel is the dominant regional superpower. The United States is the global superpower, and the two are working in tandem. So even though the United States may not like all of Israel's methods, it's not about to withdraw support, because Israel is ultimately doing what it wants, it being the United States as well.
That was Jennifer Lowenstein, former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies and Senior Lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Find more news and commentary on the escalating conflict between Israel and Hezbollah by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The first documented report of two women's deaths linked to state anti-abortion laws, made possible by the U.S. Supreme Court's 2022 ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade, eliminating women's constitutional reproductive rights, was reported last week by the investigative news outlet ProPublica. Georgia resident Amber Thurman, a 28-year-old mother, died after waiting 20 hours for a hospital to treat rare complications that occurred after she took abortion pills. The news organization also reported that a second woman from Georgia, Candy Miller, died after she avoided seeing a doctor after taking abortion pills that caused unusual complications, out of fear of violating the state's extreme abortion law that makes it a felony for a doctor to perform an abortion, punishable by up to 99 years in prison. Your reporter spoke with Amy Littlefield, the abortion access correspondent with The Nation magazine, who talks about her recent article titled, "An Abortion Ban Killed Amber Thurman, and Likely Many More," with a focus on how these deaths may carry political consequences in this year's presidential and congressional election.
Since Roe v. Wade was overturned, a lot of us who follow this issue have been waiting, holding our breaths, waiting to find out who are, as I put it in an article I wrote for The Nation last year, who our dead woman would be, who the woman, the first person who we were going to learn had died as a result of an abortion ban post-Dobbs would be. And we know her name now, and it's Amber Nicole Thurman. And she was 28. She worked as a medical assistant. She had a six-year-old boy. She loved to take him to petting zoos and the beach. And as was terribly predictable, you know, in a country where we know Black women seek abortions at higher rates and also die far more commonly from maternal health complications, she was a young Black woman. And she died because doctors in Georgia did not perform a very simple routine procedure to remove tissue that she had retained in a rare complication after undergoing a medication abortion. And that was because the state of Georgia had made that routine procedure that would have saved her life a felony. There's a six-week ban in Georgia that, you know, makes medical providers afraid of committing a felony and going to prison for providing medical care. And so Amber Nicole Thurman had wanted a procedural abortion in Georgia. The state had a six-week ban. She had to travel 4 hours away to North Carolina. And because she hit traffic, she missed her appointment for the procedural abortion that she wanted. She had a medication abortion instead, which in the vast majority of cases is fine. You know, she was well within the standard of care for that treatment. She suffered a rare complication, went to the hospital to have that complication treated. And again, that routine procedure that would have saved her was a felony in the state of Georgia. And so she died. There's two things that I want to point out about her death, right? One is that it was so entirely predictable that reproductive justice activists, including in the state of Georgia, which has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the country, have been screaming about how this is going to happen. If you ban abortion at 6 weeks in a state with one of the highest rates of maternal mortality in the country, you know, attorneys fighting this ban warned of this. They were ignored. And so this is where we are, you know, with this little boy starting a new school year without his mom. The other thing that I want to point out about it is just how very rare it is that we can look at the death of a young woman of color in this country that has, you know, the highest rate of maternal mortality in the developed world and pinpoint it and say it stemmed directly from this particular public policy, right? It rarely happens. The New Yorker did a piece, you know, a while back about a young woman named Yenny Glick, a Latina woman in Texas who died, you know, from pregnancy-related circumstances. And it's hard to draw a bright line and say the abortion ban killed someone. But what's so remarkable in Amber Nicole Thurman's case, ProPublica was able to pinpoint and say, yes, she died from this abortion ban because the Maternal Mortality Review Committee in the state looked at her death and said it was preventable. They ruled that it was preventable. And that should be an indictment of, you know, state policymakers in Georgia, of everyone involved who let this death that was entirely foreseeable and preventable happen.
Well, Amy, we have an election coming up November 5th with a lot at stake. In addition, there are 10 referendums across the country this November on abortion rights at the state level. Six states have already had abortion referendums, and they've all been won by the pro-choice side. What has been the response to this death of Amber Thurman by the Kamala Harris campaign? And what would your advice be to the campaign to highlight this tragic death? And what's at stake for the country in terms of reproductive rights when people go to the polls on November 5th?
Yeah, I mean, Kamala Harris, you know, to her credit, has spoken even before this about the risks and harms posed by abortion bans. I know she met with Amber Thurman's family and was on Oprah with them. You know, if I were her, I would go to Georgia. I would be in these women's hometowns. I would be with their families, holding up photos of them, emphasizing that these deaths were preventable and laying them at the feet of Republican policymakers, and not just Donald Trump, right? I mean, we have to remember abortion is an issue that has been shaped almost entirely at the state level, right? I mean, especially now, but even before the Dobbs decision, when states were like Georgia were chipping away at abortion access, it really depends on your state lawmakers, on your governor, on your attorney general. And so if I were Kamala Harris, or if I were advising her, I would say go to Georgia and maybe, you know, channeling that outrage in this state where these two vibrant young women have just died could help lead to, you know, changes down the ballot, right, that might have a direct impact on the six-week ban in this state.
That was Amy Littlefield, The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent and author of the forthcoming book titled American Crusaders, A History of the Anti-Abortion Movement Over the Last 50 Years. Find a link to her recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For the past 10 years, a climate organization named Beyond Extreme Energy, or BXE, has targeted the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, because it's the government body that decides whether to grant permits for interstate gas pipelines, liquefied natural gas or LNG export terminals, and other fossil fuel infrastructure. Over the past few decades, FERC has denied only a handful of projects, approving the vast majority of proposals submitted. BXE organizes protests at every monthly FERC commissioners meeting, both outside on the street and inside the meeting itself, where residents whose communities are threatened by fossil fuel projects or already impacted speak out, joined by climate activists in support. The monthly meeting on September 19th was attended by dozens of Gulf Coast residents from Louisiana and Texas, who were protesting FERC's continued approval of LNG terminals in their communities. Many members of Third Act, a relatively new climate and democracy organization whose members are over 60 years old, joined the September 19th protest alongside BXE activists. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who's an original member of BXE but who didn't attend this action, spoke with Lisa Finn, an organizer with Third Act Virginia. Finn noted that BXE members supported a Third Act event in Washington, D.C. last year, and Third Act wanted to reciprocate, and describes the September 19th FERC climate protest.
You know, I realized, well, you know, kind of FERC is sort of the BXE lane, and it really seemed to be a good thing for Third Act to get involved in, and because it's a nice introduction to disruption and direct action, nonviolent direct action.
Lisa Finn, this particular one, there were dozens of people who came up from the Gulf Coast, from Louisiana and Texas, who were specifically concerned about the increasing build-out of so-called liquefied natural gas, or LNG, export terminals that have contaminated their lives and also turbocharged climate impacts. And FERC has to approve all these projects. So the action on September 19th involved a blockade outside, then a rally, then disruption of the meeting itself. Can you tell us how it all unfolded?
I kind of thought of it like as a three-ring circus. So we started out with the blockade at 7:30 in the morning. We had seven rocking chairs. The people that sat in them were all Third Actors, and some of them from Ohio, Charlottesville. Then we were able to sit there for an hour. There was no police presence, which was for a while, which was kind of interesting and surprising. And then we moved our rocking chairs over to for the rally part. And I will say that having the Gulf South folks, frontline communities there, it really kind of hammered home, you know, just what we need to be doing. We need to be showing up for these people. And, you know, I think that they were really happy that we were there because they're the ones being affected first. We're all going to be affected, but they're the ones that have been affected most and are directly, you know, involved in these things. And then, you know, they talked about the DC Court of Appeals that struck down these projects, but FERC has not made these projects stop. So it really kind of struck home of what FERC was still doing and has been doing for many years. The rally was awesome. And then we had, you know, 15 people disrupting, which was great. And they all came out and kind of commented about, you know, how they felt that the commissioners really didn't really care. I mean, they, and who knows what's going on inside their hearts and brains, but it just seemed like they would just stop talking. And then when a disruption happened, and then they would keep going when the disruption was over. So we made sure that there was 15 disruptions. That was like almost a half an hour disruptions. We had a disruption from the overflow room. We also disrupted in the lobby. So we really kind of tried to make our voices heard. And I think they heard us.
Lisa Finn, I know that a lot of people at the Action in DC are heading up to what's called Climate Week in New York City when the UN talks about climate. And there are many grassroots groups who will be in the street and also sponsoring various workshops and presentations. What do you know about what's coming up?
Yeah, so there's going to be a big blockade on the 23rd. And I think they're going to do the Citibank blockade, which, you know, kind of just reminds Citibank that, hey, yeah, summer of heat, summer is over, but we are not stopping. And I think that's really important for Citibank, their CEO and their board to know that we are going to keep going with that. And then I think Tuesday is in front of insurance organizations, which is, you know, really powerful because they're making it possible for these projects to happen. And yet here they are cutting off insurance for homes, and they're still insuring these huge projects that are very dangerous and horrible.
That was Lisa Finn, an organizer with Third Act Virginia. Learn more about BXE's monthly FERC climate protests by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, WFMP in Louisville, Kentucky, KBCS in Bellevue, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.